And it's been interesting, surprising to me sometimes about how people seek to connect, you know, this story of not only tragedy, but just the pursuit of justice to stories in their own countries and cultures. So it's not only visible globally, but it has some global significance that I've come to understand.
Come back to you, Lula. Where were you? I didn't ask you, where were you at the moment you got the information? Did I ask you that already?
You did.
Okay.
Yes.
Great. And so what I didn't ask you is to interpret this from the lens of your international presence, yeah, your family legacy, you know, what your mom and dad, and how your lineage brought you to understand and to make meaning, and also to determine what you're going to do as part of your life work.
Yeah. So I was born in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. We've always had a very abundant Black identity. The hospital I was born in is Ekor Anbesa, translates to the Black Lion. And so there is this inherent greatness we all feel from being from that country, right? So imagine our surprise when we come to this country and we are told we are less than. It's very hard to make sense of nonsense. Mm-hmm. And so I would receive these messages at home. I always say, you know, my mom, like I would wake up and she would say, "You are as great as the Nile." And then I would go to school and they would speak such negative things over me. And I never could really settle that tension. And so my response was always to create and build power with other people like me. And so Minnesota, you know, we are a large refugee resettlement state. And that's why we have a large Liberian population and East African population, as well as immigrants and refugees from other parts of the world. But also we were welcomed by Black Americans. You know, my mom is a single mom. And so when she was at work, or it was our neighbors making sure we had dinner and we had homework help, and they were all African Americans. And so my sister and I, we grew up immersed in both cultures and understanding ourselves existing in this country on the legacy of Black Americans, who also in the part of the civil rights movement ensured that there could be more immigration from places like Africa, right? So I had that clarity. And so when I learned about racial injustice committed against Black people, of course, I immediately felt a connection to it. Given not only the history in this country, but that anti-Blackness is global. And part of the reason why so many of us are here is because of the history of colonization, right? Mm-hmm. There is, of course, the transatlantic slave trade, but there's also other kinds of migration that forced us out of our homelands. It is with this lens that I came to philanthropy. And so when the uprising happened, what I did was I was like, what is my proximity to power? And at that time, because I was working at the Women's Foundation of Minnesota, I knew that there were resources that flowed every day about us and did not include us at the table. So I called my good friends, Shonda Smith Baker and Rapa McCaw. And I said, can we send out an email? Your sympathy is good, but we need real transformational change that centered what is happening, and that, and Rapa says this, truth telling is so critical. And so we did, the three of us. And from there, we started hosting conversations. When we emerged, we were called the Philanthropic Collective to Combat Anti-Blackness and Realize Racial Justice. Because off the gate, we weren't playing games.
That's right.
We were like, we're gonna call a thing, and we're gonna invite you to go beyond, back to meaning making, right? But also have a political analysis. Mm-hmm. Let's have a systems change analysis. What happened to George Floyd, may he rest in peace, was not the singular moment with this police officer. It was from the time he was born, and every single system that he touched needs to be addressed and transformed, and philanthropy has a big part in it. And so that's how the work and the vision of the Black Collective Foundation came to be. It was really because of our love for each other and our love for Black people in this community, and our commitment that when the cameras left, the legacy of loving and being permanently committed to Black people would not.
I'm Al McFarland. This is The Conversation with Al McFarland. We're broadcasting live from George Fort Square. We're at the Worldwide Outreach for Christ Church at 3808 Chicago Avenue South. This is Ground Zero. I want to invite you all to pick up a copy of Monday's Insight News. It's on the streets right now being delivered. And the cover story is a story that is entitled George Floyd, How the World Reacted. And I want to share with you some excerpts of what I wrote in that story. The subhead says, from Minneapolis to Lagos, from London to Sydney, a global reckoning ignited on the corner, or on a corner in our city. And I'm going to just read parts of it. It's a good piece. I want you to read it, react to it, respond if you will. But it goes, let's start here with a corner, the corner of 38th and Chicago, South Minneapolis. That's where it happened. That's where a 17-year-old named Darnella Frazier pointed her phone camera and held it steady. And by holding it steady, she held the world accountable. You know the story. You know it all over the Black world, and as it turns out, all over every world that there is. George Perry Floyd Jr. was murdered on May 25, 2020. Derek Chauvin, a veteran Minneapolis police officer, knelt on his neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. Three other officers looked on. Bystanders who tried to intervene were pushed back. Floyd called out for his mother. He told the officers he could not breathe, and he died. Within hours, the video was everywhere. Within days, the streets were full. And within 2 weeks, something happened that I had not seen in 50 years of covering this community, this city, this country. The world moved, not just in solidarity with us, not just in sympathy. The world moved because they recognized themselves in that image. They recognized their own corners, their own dead, their own centuries of unfinished business. That's how close it is. Minneapolis, Minnesota, a city that the world had barely heard of outside of Prince and the Vikings, became the place where a global reckoning was born. I'm going to stop there and read more a little bit later. But react to that, this whole idea of the world. And you've mentioned it, Peter. You've mentioned it, Lulette. And all of us have local and national roots. You mentioned Arkansas and the Delta. My family on my mother's side is from there. My family, my father's side, from the Caribbean. And obviously, I call myself an African in America. I'm a Black man. And so, and brother, Liberia, let's focus on what this means for the world and what the world means for the healing, the restoration that we seek. I believe that we all feel that we are working to create a space in existence that honors life itself, that honors the dignity of every human being, that respects all of the elements of creation, the sentient, the non-sentient, the mineral world, the resources that we have to steward, share, and understand what it means to be regenerative and not extractive or exploitative. I'm going to stop there. Lulette, jump in. Vibe on that.
Yeah, you know, I think about Malcolm X's plead to, you know, talk to the United Nations about what was happening to Black America, because it wasn't enough to just talk to the U.S. government. He brought a lot of the issues to a global table. And I also think about the Voting Rights Act and what happened in Selma, Alabama, where on Bloody Sunday, civil rights leaders literally got beaten down and cameras captured it. And strategically, how that moved their call forward because the world was watching, right? So there's a strategic element to a video going global, mm-hmm, because it embarrasses a nation that is not living up to its ideals. And I think that's what happened, right? It wasn't in the same way. Darnella's camera wasn't necessary. It was, what do you call it? Like community journalism. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people witnessed what happened. And our community, our nation had to answer to it. And perhaps that's why so many things moved, because the people, you know, the people organized will always be the most powerful force in this world. And you writing that, it captures the moment so beautifully, because we were part of a global movement that asked more of humanity and more of the United States of America.
So, Peter Frost, you mentioned that you were in different places, capitals around the world. Sit with that a minute and talk about how you think people were seeing, feeling, understanding, questioning you, questioning us, questioning America, questioning the profession, the professing of principles of humanity, of human rights, but everybody was watching the antithesis of it occurring at the hands of the state here in Minneapolis, right on this corner, 38th in Chicago. What do you make of that?
You know, maybe briefly, I mean, I find when I'm abroad, I'm an American. Mm-hmm. I'm not Minnesotan.
That's how
we're understood. And there are a lot of questions about America in this moment that we get. And so going back a number of years, there was curiosity. There was a lot of tell us more, help us understand, asking about the experience here. But I think underneath all of that, it was kind of a what comes next. Mm-hmm. And it was the most important thing, I think, for us abroad, but here now, is like, what's the answer to that question? What comes next? And your comment about regeneration, I guess, has me thinking about that, because I think, out of pain and tragedy and loss, there's energy. And I think what we see here is the motivation to create something new. And I think it has unlocked a level of creative energy and maybe higher expectations that is important and productive. I was thinking about, you mentioned RAPA. I was thinking about an event of the foundations that I went to a couple of years ago where RAPA was talking about, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, it was something along the lines of like, okay, there was an era of programs and initiatives and pilots, but we now need to kind of ascend to the next level of systems and institutions and policies. And I guess I would add markets, mm-hmm. Because that's where we're going to drive change at another level. And that really, I hadn't heard it articulated that way, but really stuck with me, really resonated. I've said this to other people since mm-hmm. then, but it's kind of like what comes next can be a higher standard of expectation mm-hmm. and the requirement then to be acting at a greater scale. Mm-hmm. Because the question is not, should something happen, but it's like something big needs to happen. And I think, we can talk more about some
things
going
on. We're going to come back to some big things are happening right now. So let me read a little more of the article. It says the Americas were in I Can't Breathe, Crossed Every Border. That's the subtitle in the second one to read now. It says the protests began hours after the murder right here at 38th in Chicago. They spread throughout Minneapolis, throughout St. Paul, through the metro. The third precinct burned. The Minnesota National Guard was activated in its largest deployment since World War II. The destruction, estimated at $550 million across 1,500 locations, made the Twin Cities the site of the second most destructive period of civil unrest in American history after the 1992 Los Angeles uprising. But our fires lit fires everywhere. In Washington, D.C., Muriel Bowser had the words Black Lives Matter painted in enormous yellow letters on the street in front of the White House. In Rio de Janeiro, hundreds took the streets in defense of Black lives in the favelas. And when the police met them with tear gas, the protesters answered back with Floyd's own words, I can't breathe. In Colombia, Floyd's killing arrived bookended by murders of Black men at home. Anderson Arboleda, a 19-year-old Afro-Colombian, had been beaten by Colombian police on May 19th, 2020, 6 days before Floyd died. for allegedly violating coronavirus curfew restrictions. He died 2 days later with severe head trauma. Protesters marched to the U.S. Embassy in Bogota. Their grief doubled. In September 2020, Javier Ordóñez died being brutalized in police custody. Just a second. The video shows him pleading, "Enough, no more, please." And the protests that followed turned deadly when police cracked down. A UN-backed report later categorized the deaths of 11 victims during those protests as a massacre by Colombian police. In Mexico City, portraits of George Floyd were hung on the fence outside the U.S. Embassy alongside flowers, candles, and signs reading, "Racism kills here, there, and all over the world." That's the truth. That is the whole truth. So in Europe, in Bristol, England, protesters did what civic officials had refused to do for decades. They pulled down the statue of Edward Colston, a 17th century slave trader whose name still graced concert halls and pubs in the very city he helped to build on the trafficking of over 84,000 West African men, women, and children. And they threw it into the harbor where his ships had once docked, right there in those waters. In Brussels, Belgium, demonstrators climbed the statue of King Leopold II, who presided over one of the most brutal colonial regimes in African history in the Congo, and they waved the Congolese flag. In Oxford, students renewed their campaign against the statue of Cecil Rhodes. In London, a statue of Winston Churchill was spray painted, and within days, what had begun at about 20 people outside the U.S. Embassy grew to more than 20,000, flooding the streets. I'll read a little bit more, and then we'll go back to the conversation. And maybe I'll stop there because I go on and explain what happened in Paris. And part of this talks about the reaction in Germany. We also go to what happened on the continent of Africa. And that's interesting. It's important to sit here for a quick second. My phone is slowing down to me. But it mentions that in Africa, there were the subtitle says, "Africa, a continent reckons with its own silence." And just a paragraph or two. "The African Union condemned the murder of George Floyd. That matters. But it was far too little and far too late." An African scholar writing in those days put it plainly. His death was the latest in a long line of killing of Black men, women, and children that had drawn no official response from the continent over the years, despite commitments to ending racial discrimination. Quote, "As a continent," he wrote, "we have failed our African American brothers and sisters, offering next to nothing in the way of meaningful solidarity to ensure their dignity. This is our shame." Well, we go on from there. So I want you to read the article. It's in the current edition of Insight News. It's on the street everywhere. And it has pictures of protests as they unfolded in Asia, in Africa, South America, and in Europe. The point I'm making is that this event is truly a global event. It's an event of the ages, and it's one that we have to recognize it for what it was and what it is. And we have to make sure that we do not forget. We cannot forget. We cannot stop talking about this. We have to, for the sake of the history and for the sake of our children, those that are unborn, keep this story in our mind, not to be fixated on the trauma, but to demand of us and of each other and of the world dignity, equity, fairness, growth, liberty, freedom. What are we going to do to make our world free and safe for us, and in doing so, I believe, make it free for every human being on the planet. Jump in, anybody, with a reaction, response, a comment, a criticism.
I think it was very well said, and it reminds me of an event that's going to be happening here in the Twin Cities in a couple of weeks. Dr. Sam Myers, the World Poverty Conference, and you had mentioned Rio de Janeiro and the list of cities right at the beginning. I had the good fortune actually of being in Brazil at the last conference, And to this point of America's history, it was amazing listening to the students and having them recite the many atrocities that had happened to African-Americans here in the United States, and asking how what lessons could be learned. And then also appreciating the fact that the horrendous events of violence that happened within those respective countries. On the opening night of the conference, it was in Portuguese, so my Spanish didn't really help me, but I really didn't need it, because what the artists were demonstrating was so many young women who were murdered, had been lost, no family member could find them, and how government had failed. So to this extent, it's an opportunity for the United States to lead, right? To aspire to higher ideals, and the world does watch us. So to me, you're absolutely right. When the world sees an event like this, they have to question their own hope, their own ability to change within their own country. And shame on us for not grabbing the mantle and leaning in and trying to provide leadership. The other thing, that Minnesota connection, there is a lynching here in the state of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And some individuals here in Minnesota might be unaware of a newspaper front page edition, which show the bodies of Clayton Jackson and McGee, three young African-American circus workers. They're at their base of a lamppost. And from as far as the wide angle camera can show, are people who are standing there celebrating them breaking into the jail, taking these three individuals out, and then lynching them.
Duluth.
The Duluth lynching.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point in time in 1920, that newspaper article went across the entire United States, mm-hmm. across the world, and people expected something different in Minnesota. Unfortunately, at that point in time, it was not to be. I appreciate the fact, though, that we have ethnic studies here within the state. So when we talk about the Holocaust, we talk about indigenous genocide, we're going to pick up that history, and school districts are talking about it. You can't heal if you don't address the harm. You can't get better unless you talk about how you failed. That is not to forever shame, but it is to improve upon. And I really appreciate the legislators that leaned into that space, and I appreciate the brave educators that are talking about that. And you're right. We have a duty, a responsibility not to forget to move us forward. Mm-hmm. I appreciate really Peter being here, because mm-hmm. I know from my time as a commissioner, we've had these conversations about, at that point in time, the Minnesota paradox of African-Americans had an unemployment rate of about 32%. Now Flowers was lobbying for the government to hire more people, and he was there to make sure that there was workforce participation in construction on what we play, the U.S. Bank, for the Vikings. We have to create systems of progress, not just one-time policy initiatives. That's slow, that's arduous, it's a difficult work, but we can do it if we are intentional.
Peter, 30 seconds. What are some of the major things unfolding that you're involved with? Massive, I believe, important and financial engagements.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that we should all be excited about is the Groundbreak Coalition. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the most powerful things to come out of the tragedy that occurred right here 6 years ago, which is a recognition that essentially, you have to build a better system. And so here you have a very unlikely combination of community leaders, bankers, you know, private sector players, not just from our community, but actually from across the country. This is something with national visibility and national support that took the simplest way to put it is when Tanya Allen kind of brought this idea forward, is like, what if we just turn these gaps into goals? Mm-hmm. And like that mindset shift was completely free. It didn't cost a dollar to think about that.
Turn the gaps into gold.
And say, to goals.
Goals, okay.
So the numbers didn't change, but what the numbers meant, what the numbers could mean. And since then, you know, that was quick. But then building infrastructure, mm-hmm. which was hadn't been done before, and it was innovation. I mean, I think we have to bring this idea of innovation into this conversation to get somewhere different, to build something better. We're going to have to be innovative in doing it. But today, every month, there are new Black and BIPOC homeowners that are moving into properties for the first time, you know, all across this community. And the goals are big, 11,000 more homeowners, 6,000 BIPOC-owned small businesses, you know, 60 major developments across this region. And it's just a start, but it's big. And that's the scale that we need.
Let me ask Al Flowers. Al, jump in here quickly because we're running towards the end of the program. You've got some major things coming up. Thank you for helping organize this week. You've done a great job, and I appreciate all the work you've done being on your show on Sunday on KMOJ. Powerful community conversation. What's coming up? What's on your calendar?
First, Al, let me thank you for keeping it going. Keep remembering, because they want to forget what happened to George Floyd. It's, you know, we got to keep it alive, and that's what you've been doing all week. And just to be sitting there next to Peter, last time I was there, I was at downtown at y'all last board meeting, Robbie Norman, your board chair, and Robbie's been a big part of the UBLA, the United Black Legislative Agenda, what we're pushing, seven focus areas that's helping the foundational Black, the one that was in that's been welcoming them to other immigrant communities coming here. And but we got left behind, and in this whole thing with George Floyd, we haven't advanced, the stats haven't changed for foundational Black, and I'm unapologetic about saying that's what I'm speaking for. I'm gonna continue to speak for that, like the commissioner said. I've been fighting this a long time, and talking about us, talking about foundational Black. You say ADOS, we say so many names for our community. But now I think we got it. I think this is United Black Legislative Agenda, Al, what you have been writing in the paper, what we working on together, working with people like Robbie. Peter just talked about Adair. Adair have contributed to this foundational Black thing that we're doing on June 6th at the Minneapolis NAACP office. That's going to hit. We starting with five cities, Duluth, St. Paul, Minneapolis, the two Brooklyn, Brooklyn Park and Brooklyn Center. We got mayors, city council members. We got the state president of the NAACP. We got Senator Champion. We're going to give us a legislative report. And I just keep trying to move the agenda. I'm an organizer, and I try to help get the right people in the place. And that's where we are at right now. And we have to do this because, like I said, we last in all these categories. No matter what nobody say, look at the stats. When you focus on everybody else but foundational Black, we losing. So we want to, if we're going to continue to help immigrants coming in, we got to help ourselves first. And I got to be unapologetic about what some have to slow down when they talking about it.
Commissioner, take a minute to talk about your event coming up on June.
So over the last couple of years, we have been hosting several Juneteenth events. We're going to have a brunch on June 18th, and that will be with Clint Smith, how the word is passed, how we talk about slavery, and how we have an honest conversation about it to help frame these conversations forward. Appreciate allies coming into this, and the book that's going to be provided is a young reader's book. I think we really need to figure out how we have conversations with everybody in the room. So I'm encouraging all allies to really register for that event. On the 23rd, we're going to have an essence of joy. We need to have celebration. We need to have our soul nourished.
My 20 seconds, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. So on that, it'll be G. Philip Schultz, Vocal Essence, six chefs, which will be there. And it'll be an opportunity for folks to be able to enjoy a wide range of food. Please go to the Minnesota Humanities website to learn more about the respective events that we're having. We'll have a great film on the making of America that I know that you'll enjoy.
Thank you so much. Well, over the past 6 years, communities across the globe have witnessed pain, protest, resilience, and transformation. Lasting change requires more than moments of visibility. It requires sustained connection, investment, leadership, and collective action. That is what we do here. I'm Al McFarland. We'll see you next time. Thank you.
And you are listening to KFAI Fresh Air Community Radio. KFAI 90.3 FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at KFAI.org. Non-commercial, community-powered radio. Support